Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for late May 2023. At the time we're recording, the global carbon dioxide levels are 424.72 parts per million. That's essentially 425 parts per million, which is 75 parts per million above the 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide pollution we need to be at. On top of that, there's only 2,430 days left until the year 2030, by which time we have to cut our carbon emissions. So there's plenty of work to be done. Well, the Massachusetts Climate Action Network is a nonprofit here in the Massachusetts area. It is the heading under which we make this podcast. It turns out that I am also on the board of directors of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network, which means that MCAN is a corporation. It has a structure. And the board of directors is an important component of that. The board of directors sets the vision, makes sure that the gears are turning, has responsibility for the whole shebang, as they used to say in Ireland. Anyway, recently we've had some new additions to the MCAN board, and I thought it would be fun to talk to some of those people. And today we're pleased to have with us Marissa Zampino, who is a new member of the board. Welcome, Marissa. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
So Marissa is currently a community organizer, and basically builds relationships inside communities. Before that, she worked at MassPIRG. She's done all kinds of good stuff. She graduated from Emory University with a Bachelor of Arts. And she spent time in VISTA, the AmeriCorps VISTA program. So Marissa, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to have you here.
Yeah, no, it's super good to be here again. I'm very excited.
So tell me, you've done a lot of stuff. I mean, if someone who is trying to learn about you, tell me, who are you? What do you do?
Yeah, that's such a fun question because I never know how to answer it. I usually would say, you know, I'm a community organizer. I work in the greater Boston area doing climate resiliency work. So kind of I switched from the climate mitigation and working on renewable energy and everything into really trying to work with communities that are being most affected by our current impacts of climate change and focusing that in on extreme heat in the Boston area, because that is one of our rising issues, especially in New England, for a variety of reasons. But I'm also, you know, just a person in their mid-20s. Just trying to not feel the impending doom of the multiple crises going on, hanging out with my friends and just trying to find joy in a lot of things. So,
so tell me, you said an important word there, climate resiliency. That, mm-hmm. I mean, there's always vocabulary words that pop up, right?
Yeah.
So there's climate resiliency. You said climate mitigation, which is again a buzzword for reducing carbon dioxide emissions. When you say resiliency, tell me more. I mean, give me an example of what kind of stuff you're trying to do.
Yeah. So resiliency, and actually it's funny, I usually hate using the word resiliency, and I use it only for certain audiences. Like if I'm talking to planners or other like scientists or engineers, I'll say, yes, I work in climate resiliency. But when I'm out and about in the community, what I really talk about is climate safety. I'm here to help you figure out how to keep yourself and your family safe from our changing climate. So in terms of extreme heat, what climate safety can look like is planting more trees, making sure people have access to air conditioning or cooler spaces, putting more water features in areas to help cool down the neighborhood as a whole. It can also look like putting up berms, you know, for areas that are easily flooded. We live in the Boston area. We are a coastal city that is actually a major issue. So that's kind of what it's adapting to our already changed climate and, mm-hmm. you know, accepting and knowing the fact that our climate is changed forever and we can't continue living the way that we are living. And we need to figure out different strategies and adaptations to really help those who are most affected by our warming planet.
And this is probably particularly I mean, most relevant in places that essentially don't have trees, right?
Yes.
I mean, so there's a, if you get up in an airplane, there's a lot of trees in New England, but I mean, yeah. there are some places where a lot of people live that are essentially brick and concrete, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And especially, so I work for an organization called the Mystic River Watershed Association, and we protect and restore the Mystic River. And our watershed is 21 plus communities in the greater Boston area. And even in that, you know, singular 76 square mile area, there is a major discrepancy in tree coverage and green spaces. So, for example, I work in Everett, Chelsea, Malden, a little bit in Charlestown in East Boston. And these places have essentially no tree cover compared to if you even just went, you know, a 15-minute drive out to Winchester or Lexington or even Arlington, where there's much more green spaces. And a lot of this is because of historic racist policies like redlining and then the continued disinvestment in these communities that tend to be lower income, BIPOC communities, large immigrant communities. And so these are folks that are the most vulnerable. And also at the same time, they're not usually, these communities are not the ones that are contributing to the climate crisis as well.
Yes.
But they are the ones being most affected by the climate crisis. So climate resiliency and climate safety also has a major, major equity focus where a lot of my time I focus on the communities that are not, you know, receiving and have historically not received the climate benefits compared to other communities that tend to be wealthier and whiter, even within, you know, our very small watershed.
Wow, that's fascinating. So tell me, how did you get into climate stuff, right? You could be, I mean, I guarantee you could be a lot of things, Marissa. I mean, how did you end up on this pathway? Tell me your story.
Yeah, that's a, it's a funny journey. Cause I always tell people, I always joke, I use this phrase, I'm like, I'm not a woman in STEM or I'm not an environmentalist. And a lot of that, some of that too, and trying to figure out how to word this. As a kid, I don't think the world of environmentalism, I didn't see myself in it. You know, I'm of Filipina and Italian descent, but I really present as a brown person in America. That's how I walk about life. And that's how others perceive me. And growing up, looking at, you know, environmentalists or climate spaces and seeing it on TV or even the folks that were doing it in my hometown, it was really, really white and male dominated. So even though looking back now to like what, you know, how I grew up, which was very, very environmental oriented, actually, I grew up on the beach, went to a group next to a national wildlife refuge. My dad was really interested in conservation and invested us in that. But I would still never, and still today, I still struggle with like the term like, oh, you're an environmentalist, you're an environmental activist. And that's still part of my work where it's like, I want to actively change that, especially for other young people who look like me and have similar backgrounds to say, hey, you do have a space in this climate movement. And that could be a whole other conversation.
Oh my God. Yes, absolutely. Environmentalist carries a lot of weight nowadays, right?
It does. Yeah. Yeah. And about how who's invited into the space, who's left out of the space. And, you know, then there are great young environmentalists of color who are really leading the charge on a lot of that. But I guess how I found myself in my current job is kind of a funny story. I graduated college and had no idea what I was doing with my life. I never took an environmental science class in college. Obviously, I was aware of the impacts of climate change. I don't think you can be a young millennial or Gen Z and not be aware of the effects of climate change and have it really impact your life. But when I graduated college, I just didn't know what I was doing with my life. And so somebody suggested, they're like, Marissa, you're very community oriented. You would probably do really well in an AmeriCorps VISTA service year. And so I joined AmeriCorps, and for a year I was running.
Just tell me what AmeriCorps is, kind of like the Peace Corps inside the United States, right?
Tell me. No, that's exactly it. So when I was looking into service programs, I have my own issues with the Peace Corps. I don't think it's a good program or a good idea for, you know, the United States to have a Peace Corps just based on the foundations of the Peace Corps as well and why it was founded. But AmeriCorps, I was like driving a little more with because I'm like, I'm American. I grew up in this country. You know, So AmeriCorps is essentially, it's a service year. It's a federal service year. So they send you to different parts in the U.S. and you can be doing a variety of things and different programs. Some people serve to do disaster relief. Some people do like building homes and other kind of nature-based things. Or the program that I was in, VISTA, which is Volunteers in Service to America, they essentially place you at a nonprofit that usually doesn't have great funding. At least mine didn't. Some do. Sometimes you get sent to like United Ways and I'm like, you don't need VISTAs. You can afford to pay a full-time employee. But I was sent to Morehouse College, to a small section of Morehouse College called the Morehouse College Community Revitalization Initiative, which had only one full-time staff member to do some really great community work where they really connected Morehouse students to the surrounding community outside of Morehouse through education programs, like reading programs and STEM programs. So I did that, and I found a lot of joy in that. It was good.
And that's, forgive me, that's in Georgia, right? It's out of Atlanta.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's in Atlanta, Georgia. Yeah. Because I went to school in Atlanta, Georgia. So, yeah, but grew up in southern New Jersey, and so I've also just kind of been bouncing around, the eastern seaboard for the majority of my young adult life. I've never lived in a place. Actually, now living in Somerville, it's been a year, and that's the longest I've lived in a place since leaving Atlanta.
That's better for Somerville. So there you go. Yes. Somerville's good luck.
Yeah.
So how did you end up in Somerville?
Yeah. So after my AmeriCorps year, I was really, in parts, very happy with the service that I did, but really the change that I was seeing, I didn't like the fact that it was just direct service and that we were making no systemic change. Like another VISTA, and the program is still running where I used to be in AmeriCorps VISTA. It's like you put another VISTA and you put another VISTA in, but you're not really doing anything to actually address the systemic education discrepancies between the Black and Brown communities in one part of Atlanta compared to the wealthier white communities in the other part of Atlanta. And I was like, well, what are we doing here? So I really started looking for jobs that make systemic change. And luckily it was the 2020 election. And so there were a lot of, jobs for change opening up. And also selfishly, I was like, I am not going to let, you know, the president that we had from 2016 to 2020 become president again. And if there's anything I can do, I'll do that. And I found an organization called the Student Purgs, where not only were they, you know, the largest youth voter nonpartisan turnout organization, like since the 1980s, and registering students to vote and getting students to turn out to vote. But they were also attacking it from a systemic side too, where they want to create a culture of youth voting. Like, how do we get election day off at college campuses? How do we get same day voter registration in other states to make it, number one, easier for young people to vote, but also make it exciting and fun? Mm-hmm. So I did that, and I helped.
So this is just the PIRG is the PIRG, Public Interest Research Group, right? That's
Yeah.
And you were with the Massachusetts?
I was, yeah. I was with Mass PIRG students. So there's like the Mass PIRG state, you know, and then they have different student chapters. And I was working with the student chapter at UMass Amherst. And together with the other 11 chapters at that time across the state, we helped turn out and register 50,000 students across the state of Massachusetts to vote. And I will say still my proudest moment is we increased voter turnout alone at UMass Amherst by 20 percentage points from 2016 to 2020.
That's great.
Yeah, I was like, wow. Like in the moment of it, I was like, oh, are we really making a difference? And we really, really made a difference that year. And then they asked me to stay on because I was actually just going to do an election cycle with them because I was just like, I don't know what I'm doing. And the pandemic hit and they're like, well, would you be interested in staying on? We're going to run our main campaigns are going to be environmental campaigns specifically. At that time, we were advocating for the 100% Clean Act in Massachusetts, which was last legislative cycle, but just in general, transitioning Massachusetts to 100% renewable energy. And I was like, well, I know nothing about that, but I really love working with these students. And you guys are telling me that it's the same skills that I was using in the election cycle. And if I have to just learn more about it, I will. And so that's kind of how I stumbled into climate organizing. And I think
so the same skills is what? Tell me the skills.
Yeah.
Is it rhetorical questioning, argumentation, and making a great friend?
I think the skills to be an organizer, number one, you just have to have no shame, like none at all. Like you just can't be embarrassed about anything. But actually like the skills are like just being like a very knowing how to tell your public narrative and your own story and your personal story. Just being very dedicated. And then like the classic things like, you know, knowing how to petition, like flag somebody down the street and get them invested in this project, phone bank, run events. And just overall, I think just be motivating. So there's a lot of like skills that are in that. I'm told I have a personality well suited for it.
Yes, there are. Well, you're quite good at that. So tell me, so now you come to MCAN, I would say MCAN has been fortunate to come across you, and you are now with us on the board.
I am.
What connections do you see from what MCAN is trying to do with the kind of work that you are? I mean, it's a long-winded way of saying why do you want to be on the MCAN board, or what is in it for you, right?
Yeah. Well, I think number one, so I made a transition out of the PIRGS into my current job, which was that kind of, I mentioned that earlier, transitioning kind of out of climate mitigation and into climate resiliency. And that was a very active choice because I really was just like, wow, the communities that look like me, that look like my mom, that I feel really familiar to are really being affected by climate change. And I have to be doing something right now. Like, I need other organizations and I will support other organizations who are fighting the good climate mitigation fight because those fights need to be happening at the same time. But I want to put my focus on in these communities where I feel really, really, really connected to and I'm seeing a lot of issues. When I made that switch, for the first few months, it was good. It was fun. I was like, yes, I'm really doing this work and I'm, you know, really just getting to know new people and new communities. But I've always felt a little bit, it's like a hole, like there's like a missing piece in like my climate activism, where even in my work, when people would approach us like, oh, could you work on this, you know, renewable energy bill or this wind bill or something like that. And we'd be like, oh, that's outside our scope of work. You know, we focus on the watershed. We focus on, you know, interventions and climate resiliency. That's not our theory of change. So when MCAN found me, and I've known about MCAN since my time at the PIRGS, just kind of tangentially familiar with them because obviously we're working on the PIRGS and MCAN work on very similar things, which is great. I got really excited about the opportunity because I was like, oh my gosh, this is what I'm missing, because it's great to work on, you know, obviously the climate resiliency work, but it has to be happening at the same time with continuing to push for the transition off of fossil fuels and to clean energy.
It seems there's a real close relationship between the climate safety aspects and the sort of what we do going forward. So there's this historical debt that I think you're working on now to try and, you know, help with climate safety, but you certainly don't want to be making that worse going forward, right? And so it seems like a nice synergy there that between the two aspects of your and it just, for me, like all climate stuff is connected. Everything comes back and it all is headed in the same direction. What is it, John Muir, the famous sort of racist white environmentalist?
He said some okay stuff.
He was the one who said you pull a string on something and it's connected to everything, right?
Yeah.
Fascinating. So, I got to ask, do you like to, in your bio on the MCAN website, it says you like to go roller skating. Tell me, are you an expert roller skater?
I mean, I am. You can follow me on Instagram. I always joke to folks in climate spaces who find my Instagram, and they're like, these videos are so beautiful. And I was like, yeah, you know, I'm gonna stop being a climate activist and just be a full-time roller skating influencer. But
what's
I,
your favorite roller skate brand? I mean, for your
Like the boot or like
the boot? Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, the equipment.
Yeah. Well, so I used to be on our. It's funny. I have to reveal this to folks because people are like, "How did you get so good so quick?" I'm like, "No, no. I used to be a professional artistic roller skater. This was not something I picked up." Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Really.
Yeah, I went to competitions. I was national champion at one point in my age division. Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, learn something new every day. That's great.
Yeah, yeah. I even went to the world championships once and represented the U.S., which sounds way cooler than I think it actually was. But I did get to do that.
That is fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. But I use it's an ice skating boot. So when other roller skaters see it, they're like, "What's that? Like, you're on an ice skating boot. Like, did you used to ice skate and put a plate on there?" And I was like, "No, I used to artistically roller skate." So
You have to like construct your own boot? I mean, can you go to somebody and say, "Put these rollers on this boot?"
Oh yeah, yeah. You could just go. There's a wonderful skate shop actually in New Hampshire that can do it. And there's a bunch of places. You can do it yourself. Like you can buy the boot and the plate and all the things, and you can put it together yourself if you have the right tools. I've never done it. I've always just asked somebody to do it for me. But yeah.
Wow. So there has to be a connection. We just said there's a connection of everything to climate. Mm-hmm. Let's see, roller skating, probably in a world where there's less ice, we're all going to have to be roller skating to have
There we go. No, I will also say, though, like just to connect it back to my work, I know roller skating, I think if I wasn't like a very, you know, an athlete, like I was at one point a national level athlete. And that has really driven like certain principles that I hold dear and that I put into my work where it's like, just continued hard work, determination. And then like that fact of, you know, we live in climate doomism and everything, and you can get really down about everything. But I think some of the lessons I take from roller skating is like, you just have to keep going and you have to try to keep improving it and working on yourself and working with others. And I think roller skating honestly really has shaped me in a lot of ways that you don't realize that, you know, they tell you when you're a kid, like, this is going to shape your future. You're like, no. And then I'm like, oh yeah, it's really kind of shaped my future and how I approach work and, you know, falling and just getting back up and falling and getting back up and keep going.
Fantastic. Wow. Well, there you go. Well, like, what we'll do is, Marissa, I will put, I guess I'm going to go find a roller skating sales, a roller skating shop and put that in the webpage, the show page for this show,
which will be
at the massclimateaction.org. You go in and you look for, if you want to find the podcast on the MCAM page, it's massclimateaction.org. And it says newsletter and more on the banner. Pull that down. It's got the blog. And in there is where the page will be. Dear listener, if you have any questions about the show, things we ought to be talking about, send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. We'll try. If you have questions about roller skating, send them to me and I'll forward them to Marissa. You're probably listening to the show on your smartphone using one of the modern podcast distribution apps. So please ask all of your friends to listen to us on their modern podcast distribution app. It's your Climate Action for the Week. I want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support, sending us good articles to think about every week. We would close the way we always close by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. And because of that, we have to insist the United States transform its energy sector over the next 7 years under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon that respects environmental justice communities. So, Marissa, thank you so much for coming on. It's been wonderful.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Ted.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.